So our journey continues. If you remember the first evening, I talked about the retreat being a journey. And probably by now you've your journey has taken you a few places. Been some changes as you go through the retreat. Also at the beginning of retreat, I talked about how any point in the journey, whatever happens along the way, it's useful to have the attitude right on that it's right on time. Right on time. It's often a more useful attitude than some of the alternatives that some of you can think of. For example, this shouldn't be happening. It's usually not a good alternative. Someone's to blame. Or if only, if this wasn't happening, then I could really practice. It's all kinds of attitudes that to interfere with our ability to be really present and to meet our experience in a direct, complete way. And for me, this idea of right on time supports the idea that we, that this too we can meet, this too is appropriate to bring our practice to. So in this retreat, we're giving talks on the four clear comprehensions. And sometimes when I read the English translations of the teachings of the Buddha, at least in translation, it comes across a little bit, some of the teachings, a little bit complex. And I wonder whether it's a problem of translation rather than of the original. But with these, you know, four clear comprehensions, clear comprehension of purpose, clear comprehension of suitability, clear comprehension of domain, and clear comprehension of non-delusion or of reality. I mean, I don't go around using the word suitability very often. And I don't say domain very often either. It's not like part of my normal vocabulary to use those words. I know what they mean. But perhaps these four comprehensions, and also whenever I see these concepts in Buddhism that I think maybe are a little complex, I've developed a custom of assuming that they're ordinary. And they're ordinary things that everyone does all the time. And then I look at them from that point of view, and then I see, yes, they're not really strange things to import from abroad, but rather they are things we're already doing, we can recognize we're doing them, and then we can develop and strengthen them, make them more part of our life. So these four comprehensions, first we have something we want to do. And then we consider what's the appropriate way of doing it. And then we engage in what it takes to do it. And then we learn from it. I think that's something that people do all the time. I'm sure that you have things you've done. I'm sure you've considered whether this is the time and the way and the occasion to do it. What's suitable. You then go about it, and then perhaps you learn from it. It can be as simple, I don't know if the last one comes into play here, but it could be as simple as, you know, wanting to go to the grocery store to buy milk. So what's suitable? That's what's needed, buy milk for your kid or something. What's appropriate? First stop in the bar. Get some beer. Then go buy a lotto ticket. And then finally make it to the grocery store and say, well, you know, milk's so old-fashioned. Maybe a power drink is better with caffeine. That would get the kid ready for school. No, you know, you consider what's, you know, so you want to get the milk, you consider how to do it, you consider how to, you know, how to get there efficiently maybe, and what's the right thing to get. When we do it, you know, we apply ourselves, we go to the domain, you know, the domain for milk is not the bar, but rather it's the grocery store. And then perhaps we learn from that. We learn that the grocery store we went to had expensive milk. And next time it's more suitable for my budget if I go to the place that has the same brand, but for less money. So I don't know if those silly examples give you an idea, but the idea that we do all this stuff already. And it's part of the use of our intelligence. And we're not supposed to check our intelligence at the door when you come into IRC. Just be mindful. But we here also use our intelligence in a wise way to find the path. And so here we're not buying milk, but we have something else we're doing. Each of you are doing your own purpose in doing the practice, but no one comes to this kind of practice that has the kind of demands that this kind of practice has without, I think, a significant purpose. Even though, as someone in the note last night indicated, maybe they didn't understand or didn't know, or don't have an intention that's articulated. To get up in the morning and sit and walk all day and then get up and do it again. To sit with discomfort and pain. And then you get to sit with your mind again and again. So there's a purpose. And so the classic purpose in Buddhism is to become free of the cravings and clingings, attachments that weigh us down, that burden us, that interfere with the quality of our life, interfere with the freedom of our life, and that there's a way to this. There's a practice to do it. This practice is offered for that purpose. So we come now to the third of the clear comprehensions, that of domain. And the word for domain is gochara. And it's one of the wonderful ways in which Indo-European languages are connected. The most important words sometimes don't change. And so the word for cow and go are the same, because, you know, cows are important. So go, of gochara, is cow, and chara means, is the same word as a chariot, or a career or something. It means to go. It's a way of going. So it's the place where the cows go. and it's often translated as a pasture. And I like the word pasture rather than domain, because it's a place we go and graze. It's a place that nourishes us. So what is it that nourishes our purpose? What is it that nourishes our path along the way? There's plenty of things that doesn't nourish it. And so part of this intelligence is to be able to distinguish between what brings us nourishment, what supports us, what helps us find the path that we're on, and what takes us away. And not only doesn't nourish us, but maybe even depletes us. So there's a kind of a parable that the Buddha taught, where he said that there was, if you go into the jungles in northern India and up into them, from the jungles up into the jungles, up as you climb up into the mountains, high in the mountains, there are places that are so rugged and wild that the monkeys can't live up there. It's too steep, too dangerous, doesn't work for them to live there. But if they come back down into where it's a little bit flatter, maybe hilly and jungly, it's a good place for the monkeys to live, safe for them, but it's too wild, maybe too steep still, for the hunters to go. So the monkeys are safe there. And that's their ancestral home. But then if they come down further, down into the flat parts of northern India, out of that ancestral home, then they're in danger of getting caught by the hunters. So a wise monkey stays in its ancestral home, the place just between those two, where it's safe to stay. And in this parable, the Buddha said, and similarly, you all should stay in your ancestral home. If you stay at your ancestral home, you'll be safe. It's not going to be the rugged wilds. And it's not going to be the dangerous places where there's hunters to get you. And then he goes on to say, what is your ancestral home? And he described the ancestral home as the four foundations of mindfulness. And so one of the ways of understanding the domain of practice is the place where we practice so that mindfulness can develop and open up towards freedom, to open up towards a clear insight into our life. And for that to happen, we have to really connect not only to the present moment, but we have to really be able to see clearly aspects of the present moment as they're occurring. And so the domain of practice is defined here as the four foundations of mindfulness. Not necessarily that this is the practice we do, but this is the territory of the practice. This is the home base for ourselves. Come back here, come home. And from this home, we can find our way in practice. From this home, we can address ourselves. And I know that in my own practice, I certainly spent plenty of time roaming around in places that were too steep for me to be in, or places where there were all kinds of hunter's traps ready to snap and catch me. There was times where I thought that an important part of practice was the recognition that I'd get from other people. And so I was practicing and thinking about, you know, what would, you know, how to practice for the sake of recognition. There were times when I practiced in order to, I thought practice was about, I don't know if I thought this, but the places I roamed was in the worlds of my fantasies. And I sometimes would spend a lot of time on retreat, lost in fantasy is the right word. If you're there purposefully, you're not lost, are you? You know, and I knew of, you know, all kind, you know, variety of fantasies. I had engineering fantasies, and I had sexual fantasies. I had revenge fantasies. I had career fantasies. I had glorious practice fantasies, sitting there meditating, designing the most wonderful practice career that I was going to have, the great practices I was going to do, you know, the retreats I was going to sit, where I could really practice. And maybe forgetting, I was on retreat. What about this retreat? Is there any guarantee that if I finally make it to that great pie in the sky retreat that I was going to finally do and all these practices I was going to do, that I wasn't going to then think about the next retreat? So the mind can wander off into other realms, other domains. And they're not nourishing domains. They can have pleasure to them, connected to them. That's sometimes the hook. They can have the benefit of escapism as part of it, because we don't have to be present for ourselves. It's a distraction. But we go off into these realms, and it's not the realms that are going to nourish us. It's not the ancestral homes. It's realms actually where the hunter of suffering can catch us. And then there's the realms of kind of, in some ways, misunderstanding the nature of the task of practice. There was times when I thought that really the key thing of practice was to intellectually understand something. And so I would spend my time meditating trying to figure it out intellectually. And that was kind of a dead end, but it took a while to realize that. There were times when I spent my time trying to deal with some like anger that Andrea brought up, kind of not by looking at myself, but rather having a brilliant presentation in my mind about why everyone else had to change. Someone else was wrong, and this is why they were wrong, and this is how we're going to fix them. So there's certainly a time and place to consider and think about things, to understanding, but it's not the domain of mindfulness practice that's going to nourish us. I've taken detours in practice by getting seduced by strong states of pleasure that can arise in practice, thinking that intense states of pleasure or delight or even ecstasy, that's where it's all at. And so then it's the, kind of leaning into or holding on to or chasing after states of mind like that. So there's many, many ways, that we can go that are not really the heart of the matter, not really bring us home, bring us to our ancestral home, the core home, close in, really be here for experience. And this is where the four foundations of mindfulness, I think, are pointing to. And the four foundations of mindfulness, as I've gotten to know them in the teachings, I have an interpretation of them that I think that works very nicely for me. I don't know if this is what was meant by the people who put them together, they organize them the way they do, but it works quite nicely as a path that unfolds as you go through the four foundations of mindfulness. And they build on each other, getting closer and closer to the heart of the matter. So what I'd like to do is to kind of try to describe this interpretation I have for them. And the four foundations of mindfulness begin when the Buddha describes it in this text with a word which probably just is a colloquial word, means something like now. Like if you probably notice when I give Dharma talks, it's quite common for me to start my talks by the word so. Like, so what? So, is he picking up where he left off? Or something? It's just, it's just, I don't know. I figured it out to be a transition in, so I apologize if it annoys some of you. So maybe the word here is that the Buddha uses in the text, this is a word like that, but even so, I find it a significant word. And the word is just simply the word here. Here. And Buddha says, here, a monastic, gone to the forest or the root of a tree to an empty hut, sits down, having folded one's legs crosswise, sets one body erect and establishes mindfulness in the forefront. But here. And I think here is profound. And certainly here is the, the domain of practice has to be here. The domain of practice is not going to be tomorrow, and it wasn't yesterday. It has to be here. And if it's not now, then when? If you don't do it now, is any guarantee you're going to do it tomorrow? I'll get around to it eventually. Tomorrow. When the conditions are right, I'll do it. But here, this is the domain. And so part of the people who practice mindfulness is a growing, hopefully growing appreciation of the value of being present for experience. And not just being present, but being present in order to meet our present moment experience, to really connect to it, to really be fully present, not only to be present to see it, but also to be affected by it, to let it register and feel this world of ours. So here, and so one of the words, it's a word that I use sometimes in my meditation, the word here. I use it when my mind is thinking a lot and I have a hard time settling down. And I'm fond of using, just saying the word here. And it's not a word that is trying to dismiss anything or be in conflict with anything that's going on, but it's a gentle reminder that I'm here and to let my mindfulness, my awareness, take in the experience of the present moment here. So if my mind is wandering a lot, I say the word here, and then I become aware, here is a person who has a wandering mind. This is what it's like, this is the experience here. And then I have to say it again. I can't wait too long before I say it again. But I'll say it again here, and then kind of like just recognize what's happening. And it's a very permissive, allowing, it's not trying to change anything. But it's beginning to create the anchor, to root myself, to ground myself, to establish myself here, here in this place at this time. And then slowly my mind settles down, and then eventually I stop doing the here practice, and then I can just kind of be more present in the usual way. So the text begins with here. Establishing mindfulness to the forefront here. And then the text goes on and says, ever mindful one breathes in, ever mindful one breathes out. One understands, I breathe in long. In breathing in long, one understands, I breathe in long. Breathing out long, one understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, one understands, I breathe in short. And breathing out short, one understands, I breathe out short. So here, the beginning instructions, once you're here, is to start noticing the quality of the breath, the activity of breathing. Breathing always happens in the present moment. And then to not only to know your present, be present for it, but to know the quality of the breath, some aspect of the breath, to go into it, really get in to connect to it. Is it short? Is it long? How is it? And then it goes on and says, one trains as follows. I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body. I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body. So it's a little bit hard to know what whole body means, but allowing for the fullness of the experience. So really getting to know the breath, recognizing it, and allow for the fullness of that experience of breath, to let it register, let it come in. And I found it helpful sometimes to, in being with the breath, not to be the one in charge, directing myself with the breath, to watch it and be with it, but rather to be present for the breath and allow the breath, the breathing, the experience of breathing, to affect me. And allow it to have an effect on my body. So kind of open and be receptive and allow it to have an impact, breathing out. Let it have an impact. Let it come in. Let it register. As you breathe out, let it have an impact. Let it register. Let it have an influence or an effect. And it does have one, it can have one. My very first interview with a teacher was with my Zen teacher. And I was so nervous that I couldn't speak. And he looked at me and he said, "Breathe deeply." Just breathe deeply, Gil. help me out. So, you know, breathing can have an effect, right? So, but this idea of allowing the breath, allowing breathing to have effect is kind of, I find that it kind of helps with the relaxation, the openness, the receptivity, whereas kind of looking and bearing down the breath tends to be contracting. And then it says, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formations. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formations. I shall breathe in, relaxing. I shall breathe out, relaxing. So we connect with the breath. We stay with the breaths. We start recognizing what the breaths are like, what the experience is like for us. We open ourselves up to the fullness of experience of breathing, in whatever way that makes sense for us. And then if it's appropriate, if it's suitable, we can perhaps let the breath help to relax us, to soften and relax. The softening, the relaxing, is such an important part of this practice. And then it goes on and talks about being present for your activities, your posture, being present for your different activities you do that Andrea read, and in various ways developing mindfulness of the body. And here I think of, again, this domain, our ancestral home. It isn't everything that's happening here. There's a lot that goes on here. And to simply say that our home is in the present moment leaves us in too big of a realm to live in. But to come back into our body and to feel our life, to experience our life through the vehicle of our body, to be embodied, is such an important aspect of the practice, and I think an important aspect of being at home in this world. Most of the ways that people feel not at home in themselves or not at home in the world require them to be disconnected from their body, not relaxed and settled into their body. And as we settle and relax into the body, I think it's a lot easier to feel at home in this world and connected and present for ourselves. So it's a training to come back into our body. And we have a culture, a society, where many people do activities more and more that doesn't really support kind of being rooted, centered in the body. And so finding a home base, a home domain, by connecting to our body, feeling the world through our body, as opposed to knowing the world only through our thoughts, knowing the world by how it feels, the felt sense, the connection, what goes on inside of us. So heightened sensitivity, heightened awareness through our body is the first foundation of mindfulness. The second foundation of mindfulness is the feeling tone of our experience. And again, to repeat what I said, there's a lot of things we can pay attention to in our life. And the four foundations of mindfulness is a suggestion that these are particularly useful things to pay attention to if you want to do this path of coming home, of being settled, of being connected. And by once you're in your body, it gives you access to sensing and feeling the immediacy of the feeling tone of experience. Is it pleasant or unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant? And it's remarkable, and sometimes a little bit embarrassing given how sophisticated we're supposed to be, that a lot of people's reactions to the world arises out of this very simple amoeba-like relationship to avoiding discomfort and wanting comfort. And I think even sometimes whole political philosophies have a genesis in someone who is uncomfortable. Simple discomfort, and so they're dealing with that, and they have a whole politics to back it up. So it's useful to kind of start noticing this very simple, is it pleasant or unpleasant? And because based on that, we often have a lot of reactions and responses that are, if we miss, we miss the kind of the beginning of it all. But there's something more interesting here in this teaching. And that is in the discussion the Buddha gives on the second foundation of mindfulness, or the feeling tone, the vedana, he makes a distinction between two categories of feelings, feeling tones. It's a little bit hard to know how to translate these words into English, but the literal meaning, if you take, you know, I don't know if they meant their meant was meant literally in their time even, but the literal meaning means the feelings of the flesh and feelings not of the flesh. See what Bhikkhu Bodhi says. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as worldly feelings and unworldly feelings. I don't know unworldly. The some people translate it as sensual feelings and then spiritual feelings. I kind of prefer to translate it as sensual feelings and inner feelings, inner non-sensual feelings. So here, the distinction being made here is that once you're present, can be present for your experience, present for your embodied experience, for how things unfold. As you stay present and grounded in your embodied experience, you'll become aware of it. You can become aware of a distinction between two kinds of bodily experiences you have. You can be aware of those things which, those sensations you experience that arise because your ordinary senses have been stimulated. So if you stroke your thigh, it feels pleasant, and that's a sensual pleasure because it's the senses that are being, you know, being stimulated in the ordinary way. Or you eat good food, that's considered of the flesh because the ordinary senses are being stimulated. Or you hear nice music, that's of the flesh because of the way ordinary senses. But then there's a whole other category, which is this not of the flesh. And this has to do with the sensations of our inner life. And we have an inner life, the life of the heart, life of the mind. I don't like to use the word mind for this because it lends itself to some intellectual mentality somehow, but maybe just simply the inner life. We all have an inner life. And what it means in the simplicity of that inner, what's been pointing to here is the simplicity of it, the feeling tone of it. So not the complexity of our inner life, but rather the simple, what it feels like, what's this, the texture, the quality of that inner life. So if you probably you've had an experience of being internally in turmoil, or internally at peace and settled. You probably had experiences of being contracted and tight internally, and you had experiences of being open and spacious. Experiences of love, experiences of hate, perhaps. These things that maybe we call psychological, but there's a kind of, you feel it kind of through your body. You feel your mood or your state somehow. And there can be an external sensation that is painful, while at the same time there's an internal feeling of being at rest and being at peace, feeling whole and settled. And so this distinction between an inner life and an outer life is not meant to be create a big dualism, but it does point to something important, because the suffering that Buddha's practice is supposed to address is a suffering that belongs to the inner life. If it's only about our outer life that we want to be free of suffering and have a good time, then probably we should just get more massages. You know, better food, though we can't beat the food here. And but it's the inner life which really, that I think where we really measure our happiness and well-being or our suffering is what this inner life is like, the heart. And so as we settle in through the body, connect to our body, the body becomes a very important support, a very important container, very important protector, a very important kind of reference point for helping us to hold and be present and recognize what our inner life is like, the quality of it, the simple quality of it. Which then leads to the third foundation of mindfulness, which is specifically looking at the quality of our inner life, the quality of our heart. The word is citta, and citta sometimes is translated as heart, sometimes as mind. I've translated sometimes as mood, because the general quality, general state of the mind we have, of the inner life that we have. And so, again, it's not the details of, you know, our biography and our stories and what we believe and don't believe, but rather it's the kind of overall mood or state or the quality of heart that's present. And that can be, that overall quality can be many different ways. And we become the caretaker, the custodian of this quality of our hearts. So according to the text, the way this is described, and how does a person abide contemplating citta as citta, mind as mind, heart as heart? Here, a person understands mind affected by lust as a mind affected by lust, and a mind unaffected by lust as a mind unaffected by lust. So the general state, the mood, the kind of thing we're in is here just one of lust. It isn't like there's thoughts of lust. It's more like we're kind of filled with an attitude of lust or feeling of lust, you know, like coursing through our system somehow. The mood, it kind of, the shape or the color or the quality of the mind or the heart or our mood is one of lust or craving. And what's, I think, significant in this description, there's no judgment about it. There's nothing more said except recognize that this is how it is. Sometimes it's called bare attention. Cultivating the ability to be present for our experience in and of itself as it is, without judging it, without criticizing it, without doing anything with it, just feeling and being with it. So listen to these, the rest of this through those ears of, it's okay to have these states. The task is to recognize it. Simple recognition. And leave it at that. Let it just stand there. Be there. So then it goes on. One understands mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, and mind unaffected by hate as mind unaffected by hate. One understands mind affected by delusion as mind affected by delusion, and mind unaffected by delusion as mind unaffected by delusion. So here we have another distinction being made. The mind that has colored by lust, hate, or delusion, or one of without. And sometimes when people practice mindfulness, it seems like the instructions are given, you're only supposed to know what's present. And there's so many things that are not present, you spend a lot of time tracking them all down. But there are when you've had a significant bout of being caught by something, caught up in lust or hate or delusion or fear or something, and it's no longer there, it's gone away, it's very useful to take that in, to let that register, what that feels like. Don't ignore the fact, go on, like, oh, that's history now, and go on to the next thing. Actually take in, experience that, feel the contrast between those two. Because in doing that, we can learn about the nature of attachment and the nature of freedom, what it's like to be free, what the qualities of it are. So the next time that you're caught, you might be able to kind of intuit or sense the direction of freedom because you're familiar with what it feels like, what it's like, what the system is like when you're not caught by those things. So there's a simple recognition that the inner life is colored by these things or not colored by them. But it goes on. One understands a contracted mind as a contracted mind, and a distracted mind as a distracted mind. So no judgment, just recognizing this is how it is. Contracted, distracted. One understands exalted mind as exalted mind, and an unexalted mind as an unexalted mind. One understands a surpassed mind as a surpassed mind, and an unsurpassed mind as an unsurpassed mind. One understands a concentrated mind as a concentrated mind, and an unconcentrated mind as an unconcentrated mind. Isn't that nice? So you were concentrated and then you're not. Then what your job is to know what that's like. Not to feel like, oh no, I lost it. But rather, the Buddha said, great. Now that you're not concentrated, now you get to recognize what this unconcentrated state is like. And one understands a liberated mind as a liberated mind and an unliberated mind as an unliberated mind. So I like to think of these as the quality of the mind, the state, general state of the mind that the mind is in. So we start with being here, the general domain. Then the specific, more specific domain is the body. And within the body experience, we start differentiating. It allows us to differentiate between the inner body and the outer body, between the sensual realm and the inner realm of experience, of heart, mind. And then we start becoming, noticing the quality, the characteristics of this inner life, the mind, the state that we have. And you start seeing it's variable, it changes. Changes over the day, changes over time. Changes as we practice. There are times when the mind can feel quite spacious and open, expansive. Other times it feels contracted and tight. Times where it clearly feels the mind is caught, and times when the mind feels like it's not caught. Times when the mind feels like it's scattered or distracted. So as I recognize, just recognizing this, and part of the training here, as I've said, is a training to do this to be aware of this in a non-reactive way, to see it for what it is, and be in a certain kind of way be okay with it. It's a training to be non-reactive, non-judgmental. This is how it is. So then this is the foundation now for the fourth foundation, the mindfulness. And the fourth foundation the changes a little bit here now. Because the earlier was just about mostly just seeing things as they were, as they are. Here, it's beginning to understand things more deeply, understand the cause and effect relationship of things, the origins of things, what triggers things, what helps us abandon things that are not skillful to have. It involves more understanding. And it moves us into the more specific area of what helps us to either be caught, enslaved in servitude to our desires and fears and angers, and what helps us to be free. So if what we want to do is this path of freedom or the path as the Buddha says it here, I wanted to read it. This is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. So to overcome our pain and grief, sorrow and lamentation, to experience the relief, release, the freedom of Nibbana. So it takes, we have to kind of go in, it's like these concentric circles, we're coming closer and closer into the heart, into our heart of the matter, heart of ourselves. And now we start looking at how we behave internally, what goes on inside in our hearts, and what are the forces of that gets us caught. It begins by talking about the five hindrances and recognizing how these hindrances arise and how we can let go of them. So not just simply to recognize hindrances when they're there, but again, it's part of our intelligence to begin kind of looking and being present So we can see how it works, see how that magic is performed. And then to start seeing something about what the beautiful qualities of mind that arise, things like joy and peace and equanimity, how do we bring these about? And what supports the presence of those? And then it ends with a discussion of the Four Noble Truths. To be able to see clearly where we get caught, how we get caught, how we hold on to things, how we grasp and crave, and how that grasping and craving gives rise to suffering. And this, seeing this, then with time, helps us to discover the ability to let go, or that the heart has the ability to let go. The heart doesn't have to cling to anything. It doesn't have to cling to its sorrow. It doesn't have to cling to the desire that gave birth to the sorrow. So the so these concentric circles, first the present moment, train ourselves to be here, and then to drop into our body and connect to our body and let that be our home. And then within that home, that ancestral territory, there is the very simple quality of the feeling tone, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, what's happening. And that perhaps opens up or points to the inner aspect of that and the outer aspect of that. And if we keep going in, closer in to the heart, then we start becoming aware of this world, of the heart itself, the quality of it. Does it feel pleasant or unpleasant, our inner state? Again, there's no judgment here, just know it as it is. And then as we get to know it better and present for it more, closer in still, then you can become aware of the general state, the mood of that inner life, quality of the mind. And as we start seeing the variable quality and how it changes and it's in flux, one way, one time, and other ways, another time, that it's not a fixed thing, then you can start seeing the conditions that affect the quality of the mind. We can notice the effect that desire and fear and anger, aversion has, clinging has, craving has. We can notice what the effect of mindfulness has, what the effect of investigation, of effort and energy, of tranquility and calm, the effect of concentration, of equanimity, effect of joy, of happiness. Start understanding the effect and the causes of these things. And then eventually to get to right to the heart, the closest and most intimate heart of the matter, which is, again, maybe connected to this topic of intention. If anything qualifies as the self in Buddhism, perhaps this is our intention, the choices we make. And are the choices we make, not the necessarily large ones, but even the smallest ones, of what we choose to think, what we pursue in our minds, what we react to, is there any craving or clinging, grasping? Is there any drivenness, any holding, any freezing, any resistance that is going on? Because if there is, it's getting you should know you're getting close to the heart. You're getting close in. If you find the place of holding and resistance, you're getting close to something very precious. In this analogy of these concentric circles, you're getting right to the heart of it. And that is the possibility of releasing the way the heart, the mind, clenches and holds, resists, and then becomes free. So here we are. Anything more to say? Here we are. That's a profound statement. Here we are. And what is it, what would it be for you to embody here we are, to let your body fill in, take in here. Let your body participate with your mind to really be here, grounded, rooted, present. To let the mind and the body work together, to stay connected to here, to not let the mind wander off. If you stay connected to your body will help you help the mind not wander off so far. And then as you settle in and settle in, there's this process of becoming closer and closer into the heart of the matter. And each of you has a beautiful heart. Beautiful hearts. It's well worth coming close in, connecting to your heart, and letting that heart of yours be free. Let's take a minute or so to be here.